Evident Footprint Show, where we talk about government, music, art, health, science, ufology, religion, metaphysics, and all things spiritual. In short, we'll examine the truth, and when we find things that aren't right, we'll offer creative solutions. And now, the host of Evident Footprints, Don Nikoloff. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'm your host, Don Nikoloff, and I'll be with you for the next hour on this June the 24th on the West Coast, now June the 25th on the East Coast and in the Central Time Zone. We'd like to also welcome those listening in on Wind Talkers Radio Network around the world and hope you find tonight's show informative. And revealing. Why revealing? Well, tonight we have with us scientist, inventor, author, lecturer, and teacher, Mr. Jim Murray. And we're going to discuss what we didn't get discussed last week and the week before that and the week before that. So with that, I welcome to the show my good friend and co-host, our resident science advisor, Jim Murray. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, Don. Thank you. It's good to be here as usual.
Well,
you sound kind of revved up tonight.
Oh, I'm revved up. I'm always revved up, Jim. It's just sometimes I sound more revved than others, I guess. But the beauty is in the ears of the beholder. So anyway,
you coined a new word.
Yes, well, it's a combination of English and German. It comes from the verb hören, which means to hear. So, anyway, we've been trying to tackle this topic of anti-gravity, for one thing, and we've gone off on some tangents, but they're well-intended, of course, and when we do that, we are trying to fit the information within a specific period of time, and it doesn't always work out that way. But I know you had something else you wanted to bring to the mix anyway, so I wanted to give you that opportunity, and let's see where we go. We may not even talk about anti-gravity tonight, so go ahead.
Well, it's not that I'm trying to avoid the subject. It's actually a pretty interesting subject. And, you know, I'm sure that it embraces a lot of philosophical and technological issues that we could talk for hours about. But the reason that I asked your permission to deviate a little bit from that, at least at the beginning of the show, is because I came across something during the course of the week which really excited me. And I thought it was something worth sharing because of the fact that it's so unique and so interesting. And basically what it has to do with is artifacts from the past that that actually have caused change in the present. Let's put it that way.
Mm-hmm.
For listeners who are familiar with my background, when I was in college many years ago, I had the very deep pleasure of meeting and working with Ivan Sanderson for a number of years, and he was a very unusual guy. He was a naturalist. He was actually an entomologist by training, but he had gotten off onto the mysteries of the world, and as a result of that, he had established an organization called SITU, which stands for Society for the Investigation of the Unexplained. And through him, I had met all kinds of unusual individuals and also got exposed to a variety of exciting topics. And he was writing a book at the time that I met him, and I have to plead ignorance because I don't remember the title of the book. I do have it in my library back in New Jersey. But essentially, one of the chapters touched upon these little artifacts that had been found in various South American and Middle American or Central American countries. And some of them, they were all made of gold, and some of them depicted little miniature airplanes and bulldozers, backhoes, and a variety of other devices, which generally would be considered to be of a high-tech nature and shouldn't have been found in, you know, 1,200 to 1,400-year-old grave sites. But anyway, they were there, and they persisted. And, of course, the archaeologists who eventually got to examine these things pooh-hooed the idea that they could be anything but replicas of flying fish or birds or insects. And they came up with all sorts of potential arguments as to what they were, rather than just looking at them and taking them for their face value. Of course, the most interesting argument of all, in my opinion, was the idea of calling these little airplanes birds or insects, because in the insect world, you don't have too many, and for that matter, in the bird world, you don't have too many animals that have a vertical stabilizer in the middle of their back. And, you know, that was what the model depicted. So it looked like a rudder to me, but they were trying to pass it off as part of a bird. Well, anyway, that's the foundation of the whole thing. And this week, I was shown an article on YouTube by a friend of mine concerning a young group of aeronautics-type enthusiasts who had gotten a hold of a very detailed set of photographs of these ancient artifacts. And one of them said, hey, you know, it would be interesting to scale them up exactly the way they are and see if they can fly. Well, the plane that they chose was the most unusual of the lot because it didn't have normal wings. It had wings with these very odd projections, they almost looked like a wave pattern on the leading edge of the wings. And through each of the undulations of these waves, there was a hole. And I forget how many there are, but maybe there's like five or six on each wing, that type of thing. And so they went and actually built one of these suckers by scaling it up and modeling everything the way they knew it should be to give the appearance of the little gold figurine, and they put an engine in it. And not only did the doggone thing fly, but it had more maneuverability and more control than most of our modern airplanes do. And the interesting thing was they couldn't make it stall. And, you know, stalling is a real big problem if you're coming in for a landing and you get the wrong kind of wind shear. You can wreck the plane. But the thing that was the most interesting of all was that when they opened up the throttle the whole way, all of a sudden this high-pitched scream came from the model, and it began to climb, you know, almost vertically with unbelievable power, so much to the point that they couldn't control it with the stabilizers that they had put on the plane, and they had the little radio control unit. And they were forced to slow it down to regain control of it. But it had so much lift when the throttle was wide open that it just defied, you know, aeronautical knowledge. And so now they are trying to get permission to put this model that they built into a wind tunnel to see if they can figure out the patterns of airflow that are caused by these really unusual wings. Now, there were probably no airports or civilizations around 1400 years ago, but the theory is that the figurines were models that were made of things that were seen, recorded, and described in a much earlier era, and of course, that makes perfect sense to me. But the whole point of this little soliloquy is that here's a tidbit of a remnant from a technology that isn't supposed to be there, that lay dormant for heaven knows how many years in these tombs that they were found in Central and South America. And through the efforts of some enthusiasts in our day and age, they have now reproduced and flown something which, of course, according to the archaeologists, was nothing more than a model of a flying fish or a bird. But we don't have too many birds that have vortex lift characteristics on their wings. So I think that I just wanted to share my enthusiasm about this whole thing because, to me, it's a pretty amazing thing that these boys accomplished, and it seems to lend a great deal of support to the fact that, obviously, this world's history is anything but the way that they describe it to us. And I go so far to say this, if these small little metal figurines have survived from the past and transferred knowledge into our time period, what about all the stuff that isn't discovered yet? We already know that the Egyptians used gliders. They've been actually found in the tombs. They fly just fine. And it's becoming more and more obvious that technologies from the past that have survived seem to indicate that there was a golden age on Earth. There was a higher civilization prior to the ones that we have created. And the interesting feeling that I get from this, and I bounced it off of Don earlier before the show, is it seems to me, just from what my personal work has uncovered and from reports that I've read and listened to about things similar to the one that I just described, and a whole host of other indicators, seem to suggest that mankind is approaching a fork in the road. And if we go down one side of this fork, we're probably going to witness the dawning of another golden age where this planet could really change and become something really exciting and worthwhile. But if we go down the other possible fork in the road, I'd say there's a very excellent chance that in a short time we'll be reduced to another Stone Age or, at best, Dark Age episode for mankind, which is going to last for a very long and painful period. So I just thought that's worth relating, and we can wrap it right there, Don, or you can add to it your own impressions, because I know you have plenty.
Well, I can comment at least. It seems to me that either they witnessed these craft in either in the flesh or they saw some representation of these craft. And one would say, oh, but 1,400 years ago, they didn't have airplanes in those days. My God, they had flying saucers during the time of Jesus. They had flying saucers during the time that the pyramids were built. They had flying saucers a half a million years ago. So it's no great feat to have built or seen something resembling an airplane, a fixed-wing structure, we'll say, or any kind of winged machine that might have been created at that time. Yeah, I get tired of it, and I agree with you, Jim, that there is an increasing level of consciousness, and that's why you have the desperation from these idiots who are desperately clinging on to the illusory world that they have created. They really don't get the picture, you know? It's all based on illusion anyway. So they're just trying to stick to the one illusion that they're familiar with. They and their bedfellows. And I do mean it that way. but you also have this off-planet influence pulling the strings and dictating how things are going to be. And, of course, they're promised things. I'm sure they've been promised the keys to the city on Mars and the keys to the city on some other planets and likely on some, maybe possibly even in some other galaxies. But nonetheless, it's quite obvious that that they have to lie about our history because it reveals who they are. That's the whole reason for the lying and the secrecy. To admit that these things existed, well, now I can hear somebody attributing it to the wild imagination of a child. You know, that they developed something that appeared to resemble an airplane, but it wasn't really an airplane because we didn't have kerosene back in those days, or we didn't have oil. And again, it's going to be another series of lies. Lie after lie after lie. And you can't get into any meaningful conversation with anybody that represents the government or represents science because they're trying to disguise everything they're doing as if we can't discern what's going on or we can't anticipate that there's some new weapon that they've created. Again, everything they do is based on destruction. And what you're talking about is creation. So I agree with your conclusions. And I wonder if the powers that be had built a plane like this, if they would try to modify it in some way, as if they could improve upon it. You know, they haven't been able to stop airplanes from crashing. You know, their answer to explaining why is a black box, an indestructible black box that they can't seem to even find after these mysterious crashes. So we get a lot of hooey from them in regard to the reality, and it's up to us to start making the changes that have to occur. And that's very liberating to be able to do that. Now, imagine you're talking about airplanes, and certainly the way these planes flew, it's similar to how the fish climb the waterfall. And basically effortlessly, there's some secret secret. It's been kept secret, but there's a principle at work that anyone can tap into, and the question is, why aren't we doing it? Why aren't we taking advantage of those things?
You see, that's the whole point right there. You just brought it out. I mean, there's nothing stopping people from making independent investigations. Nobody paid these people to build these models and to try this this interesting experiment, but they got hooked. They got hooked on the concept. Hey, what if this is a genuine artifact that represents something that used to be on Earth? You know, why does it have different wing structures than the airplanes that we have if it's really a plane? And if it's a bug or flying fish, as the archaeologists say, then it ought not to fly, at least not at supersonic speeds, and have this incredible lift characteristic. So, you know, they took it upon themselves to solve the mystery. Now, maybe they didn't come up with anything that's totally earth-shattering, because obviously no airplane company is starting to put them on their production line. But, you know, they took the initiative, and they learned something, and they changed the world by doing this. And, you know, the interesting thing is, you can go on YouTube and see the same thing that I saw. It's all right there. Just go and do a search for Mayan airplanes. I think it came under that heading. And they have a video and the whole thing. They even show you the little miniature plane flying under radio control and how it practically tears away from the operator when he opens the throttle up too far. And the guy also gives a preamble to the demonstration, which covers all of the various artifacts and the other kind of things that seem to be indicative of higher technologies that were once on this planet. And it's worth looking at. And interestingly enough, Don, it does lead into this whole thing of anti-gravity and the other topics that we wanted to cover, because there's a very obvious that when you look at some of these megalithic constructions that were left on the Earth by somebody, they were not done by groups of slaves, because the rocks are so big and so perfectly shaped that you couldn't get enough slaves around them to lift them. I mean, some of them weigh 1,500 to 2,000 tons. You know, I don't care how many slaves you have, you can't get enough human bodies around a rock that heavy to exert the force necessary to lift it. Never mind position it with absolute accuracy and put it in such a situation where it's capable of maintaining its position and its accuracy for thousands of years. Other cultures built on top of them because they said, oh, well, we don't know where they came from, but they're excellent foundation for our temples and stuff like that. And yeah. You find them in various parts of the world.
Imagine
the
what
point
you would
is have... that in order to build something like that, they must have had control over the force of gravity. There's no other way you can explain it.
Yes. Imagine what the size of a lever that they would have had to use to maintain some sort of a shift in the position of the rock. If they were able to do this with slaves, they would still have to reposition it. They would have to be able to tip it slightly to one side. The whole concept is absurd, the way they taught it in the schools and the way they're still teaching it. So that's a given. Speaking of gravity, Jim, we've talked about gravity on some past shows, but for new listeners we have, and for the purpose of this context that we're bringing this out in, could you expound for a minute or so on your definition of what gravity is, or what it may be, because the mainstream science community has not accurately described what the phenomenon of gravity actually is, the cause of it, and how it operates.
Well, I can't give you an absolute, concrete, bona fide explanation of it, because frankly I haven't achieved that level of understanding. But what I can do, and I'm happy to do, is to give you some insights into my thinking on the subject and explain where those thoughts came from. When I was studying physics many years ago, I found it incredibly difficult to believe that two bricks, just to use those as an example, would have an affinity to attract one another just because they have mass. my truth meter inside me just said, no, that doesn't work for me. And so I began reading a great deal on the subject. And I came across quite a few things that seemed to indicate that all is not well with the Newtonian version of the gravitational theory. One of the most interesting things was there was a mine in South Africa that's one of the deepest ones ever dug, and I don't remember the statistics anymore, but let's say that it goes down 4 or 5 miles before it branches out and turns into a series of tunnels. And I think it was a diamond mine or a gold mine. It was something precious, some form of precious material that they were after. And this mine had been played out, and they decided to do a really interesting experiment. And what they did was they put a beam across the top of the elevator shaft, and it gave them a literally straight drop of whatever the shaft depth was, 2 or 3 miles, straight down, in which to do some interesting experiments. And so they wanted to make measurements that would confirm the theories of gravity as they are taught. And so they took a piano wire, or, you know, very strong metallic wire, and tied it to these beams in two places, a known distance apart from one another, and they unraveled that thing all the way down and hung a plumb bob on the end of each one of them, and they suspended those plumb bobs in 55-gallon drums of oil so that they would be dampened from any seismic activities, and once they found their equilibrium, they would just be reasonably stationary. And then they used the best measuring equipment of the day to find out how far apart the plumb bobs were at the bottom and how far apart the wire, the source of the wire, was at the top. And, of course, they knew the distance in between. And their whole concept was to see, according to what we understand about gravity and the dimensions of the planet, how much of a convergence there would be of these two lines as they descended into the depths. And lo and behold, what they found out was, instead of being closer at the bottom, they were further apart at the bottom, which suggests that the center of gravity of that system is somewhere out in space and not at the geometric center of the planet, which is a very intriguing thing if you give it some thought. And, of course, that experiment was hushed up because nobody wanted to publish something which was in contrast to the way things are presently understood. But then I started meeting people like Carini and Goetz and all these different ones, and started reading about the works of other guys like Wilhelm Reich, for instance. And the conclusion that I've come to personally is that gravity is not something that pulls from our planet to other objects, but rather it's a push. It's a push coming from the surrounding space and driving toward our planet. And it probably is a flow of ether that is impinging upon the planet from all directions and winds up creating secondary effects, like, for instance, the motion of the planet, the high temperatures that we measure around the equator and toward the core of the planet. All these things are secondary effects that have to do with the momentum of this ether as it collides with the planet on its way down from the surrounding space. And, of course, anything that gets in the way of this stream experiences a force. It's an exchange of momentum. And I think that the ancients knew about this, and they also knew that there are certain types of vibrations and other characteristics, perhaps electromagnetic or electrostatic, that interfere with this flow and can be utilized in a constructive manner once you understand how to play the game. And eventually they learned how to move these heavy weights by the application of acoustics and various sounds, and eventually they built craft that nullified their own weight. And I'm sure that there's more than one way to do that, just like we have many, many types of airplanes and things that fly in the air. So in the old days, when they understood this force, they could overpower it by more than one method. And so you have the possibility for these flying discs, you have the possibility for vortex planes, you have the possibility for moving these gigantic rocks and boulders and dressed stones and obelisks and God only knows what else with the application of sound. And if you read some of the things that were written, for instance, back in the days of King Arthur, 500 and 600 AD, concerning activities in England, they talk about the building of Stonehenge and the setting up of menhirs and other standing stones throughout various parts of Europe. And they talk about the fact that they were moved Merlin's engines. Of course, they don't tell you what that is, but the mere fact that they call it an engine and it's actually written that way seems to suggest that somebody had a technology that was capable of doing these things. And all of that has been lost to us. But the interesting thing is, if it was discovered once, it can be discovered again. It just takes a certain amount of effort and understanding and looking at something from a different perspective, just like those young engineers did with that scaled-up version of the little gold airplane.
Yeah, it appears, and I agree with what you're saying here. I've always understood gravity. And this is intuitive. It was never taught to me. I always understood gravity to be some kind of a force, not necessarily a magnetic force either, which I can remember in school hearing that gravity is this magnetic force, and that was to cause us to understand this pull sensation like you get when you take graphite and put it in the presence of a powerful magnet. The magnet pulls all of the graphite to itself. How do you explain birds, tiny little birds, which in opposition to that force would have to struggle more to liberate themselves from the push, yet they do it effortlessly, which shows that there's a link between these realms of energy, these phenomena that you and I have discussed on past shows when we were talking about the movement of water and the movement of electricity through a wire, whether it's a straight wire or a coil. There are energy grids that probably at some point are available to even a bird, that the bird can simply jump off the ground and defy gravity instantly. So There has to be a combination of using the laws of nature to one's benefit, and a bird seems to do that all the time. And the other would be to approach the issue from a more realistic point of view, and that's considering that it is a force pushing down rather than something pulling us downward. So that's my two cents, Jim.
Well, I mean, these things all come together in various ways, and it's just a question of actually seeing it for what it is.
Mm-hmm.
I have these things happen to me quite frequently, and I always hoped that the day would come when I would be in a position to apply some of my talents toward understanding gravity, especially from the different gut feelings and inspirations that I've had about it over the years. But it's amazing how this trick of consciousness works. You know, I've been working with these electromagnetic devices now for, oh gosh, I don't know, 40 some odd years, and I've experimented with so many different arrangements and so many different geometries to try and have these forces reveal to me something new by forcing them into manifestations of an unusual nature and then studying the results. And, you know, you get to the point where you say to yourself, well, I guess I've learned all I can from that particular thing, because I've been messing with it now for months, and I've written down everything that I've learned about it. I don't think there's anything else there. And I had this thing happen to me just, I'm telling you, it was just a week or so ago. I can't tell you what it was because it's proprietary information, but the thing that was so amazing about it was I had actually been working with this particular shape for many years in an effort to produce a particular result. And I just decided on the spur of the moment to make a small change in the thing, just to see what would occur. And what was interesting about it was I brought it to a machine shop. I told them what I wanted done, and they did it for me. I brought it back and set the thing up, and my attention was fixated on the change that I made and the results that I was anticipating. And what happened was that the changes I made produced a result that I was not anticipating, which was probably 10 or 20 times more important than what I was tinkering with. And it was so profound when I saw it. I said, oh, my God, you know, I've only been looking at this thing for the past 25 years, and here it is showing me something new. And it's totally unexpected. And that's exactly the kind of thing that I think is going to happen with somebody somewhere concerning this force of gravity. There is going to be a revelation which is going to just turn on in somebody's head. They're going to say, wait a minute, that's not the way it's supposed to be, but that makes sense. I keep thinking about that guy we discussed once before, and I can never remember his name. I apologize for that. Who built the Coral Castle down in Florida with these huge blocks of coral, and had no cranes, no sophisticated tools, nothing unusual except what he called control of the Earth's magnetic flow. That's what he happened to call it. And after he built this huge castle, The interesting thing was that he had to move it 100 miles or some fantastic distance from where he originally built it. And he actually only hired a couple of big trucks and a couple of drivers, and he did everything else himself. And he would force them to go and stand, you know, off to the side somewhere and not look. And then he would do something, and they'd come back, and two or three of these monstrous, huge coral blocks would be removed from his castle and be on the truck. Now, I mean, this is documented stuff for the moving companies and what have you that helped him do this. And if you go and see this Carl Castle today, I mean, it's got doors that must weigh 10 tons that just pivot, you know, miraculously with the touch of a finger. And when you see, you know, the size of these blocks that he was dealing with, and you read the little brochure about the place, it's pretty phenomenal because he did it all alone. Didn't have any help. And you're not going to tell me he didn't discover something. I don't care how strong you are. You're not going to take a 10-ton block and put it up on a truck by yourself. So that's what I think is going to happen, just like it happened to that guy, just like it happened to the Tibetan monks, just like it happened to somebody in Egypt that was studying the right thing at the right time, had his mind open to inspiration. And all of a sudden, bing, in comes a new thought. And I'm telling you, when that happens to you, it is so amazing the way it feels. It's just so humbling. It's amazing. And I'm sure that these guys went with the flow. And that's how it was learned in the past, and that's how it's going to be learned by somebody somewhere in the modern world, if it hasn't already happened.
Yes. Now, what? While you're talking, I'm sure there were probably some specific parameters involved in both the design of the blocks that he used. In other words, there were probably divine proportions at work, which is usually the case. That's what you have in a pyramid as a structure itself. The blocks that make up the pyramid, them, regardless of where they are in within the shape, add up to a sacred number. And how the blocks are laid out on the ground also correspond, again, with a sacred number. And when you get a structure with two of these sacred numbers operating, and sacred numbers, by the way, are usually unending numbers on the decimal side. They keep going to infinity, which suggests that if the structure has anything to do with energy or is able to produce energy or affect the things that are in proximity to it or inside of it, like a pyramid, it brings some other element into the equation. We tend to look just at the physical. Like I was saying last week, making this repetitive comment that we're not looking at what's in the water, we're just looking at the water. And somebody's going to say, well, there's just hydrogen and oxygen in the water. But I'm speaking of that unknown or that intangible, that invisible essence of what's there, permeating the whole of the universe. So I suppose if you can harness that principle and focus that principle, you can do miraculous feats of lifting 20,000 pound stones or 20 ton stones or whatever. And I think that the understanding that principle opens up the door to understanding what anti-gravity would be and how that would work. It seems, Jim, in this reality, everything is always dealt with force. Doesn't matter if it's mental force or physical force, but always two forces countering each other. You know, a person makes a decision to walk across the street. The powers that be create a law that says it's prohibited to walk across the street, and they exert the force to prevent you from doing it. Now, that's more of an allegory, but or a metaphor, but nonetheless, that's the approach they use scientifically. And I'm not talking about what technology they got from the aliens. I'm speaking about through our dogmatic sciences. Any comment?
Well, yeah, I mean, these forces, you know, they all have natures to them which are not necessarily 100% obvious. We seem to hone in on only one aspect of something and then make the great announcement that we now understand it completely.
Mm-hmm.
And I realize it's a human tendency to do that. It ties in with, you know, our desire to understand things and be creative and a little bit of personal ego in there and, you know, fear of the unknown and all these other things all add up to us taking a particular stance about something. But what Reich used to say was that the health of the individual and his senses has everything to do with what he actually sees when he looks at something. And, you know, if there's any truth to that statement, and I have a feeling that there is, then people who are very neurotic are not going to see the same things that somebody else sees, even if the stimuli are all the same, because it's not only a function of the senses that allows us to make perceptions, but it's a function of the mind. And the mind has to work in conjunction with the senses in order for us to perceive reality. The real trick here is there an ultimate reality, or, you know, are all these things modulated to some extent by our subjective points of view? And if that's the case, then that means that even though we're all living on the same planet, the world is a different place for each individual. And that's a kind of a strange but interesting way of looking at things. But it does explain how some people just notice something and then wind up making an enormous contribution to the general good, like the Wright brothers, for instance. Or I almost hate to use this example because it's been beaten to death, but Einstein or Tesla. You know, those are the kinds of individuals that come along and they're looking at the same stimuli that everybody else looked at, and they see something different, and they say, "Hey, this is real. I'm going to do something with it." And it changes the world. And my personal quest to understand some of Tesla's lost stuff was the motivation that propelled me to try and find, you know, that blue notebook and to understand what it was that Otis Carr was building, since he supposedly got it from Tesla. And incidentally, the Bluebird, that spaceship that I worked on, was supposed to be an anti-gravity device. And, you know, to this day, I never saw any rhyme or reason to what the actual structure was supposed to accomplish that would explain the interconnection. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't there.
Mm-hmm.
And if that notebook truly did originate with Tesla, as I suspect it may have, And it's very possible that there was some really important information in there. And
yes.
It's a shame that it's lost. Incidentally, my friend from Northern Michigan passed away here not too long ago, which is a shame because he was one of the few people left alive who witnessed a lot of the stuff that we've been talking about here on this show. He was 84, I think, when he died. But it's interesting because, you know, the town that he lived in and the whole community was so aware of this flying saucer and all of this commotion about aliens and unknown technologies and what have you. And yet, in the long run, it seems that the only person who got anything out of it was me, because they wound up scrapping the whole thing. And I talked to the guy's daughter here just a little while ago, and it turns out that the only thing left from that whole big 32-foot flying saucer is the central cab, and it's sitting down there behind one of the buildings in the town with a piece of canvas over it. And I can only imagine that it won't be worth much in the very near future. But at any rate, it's just funny how things go. If that was truly a product of Tesla's genius, it's remarkable, and yet it's sad at the same time to see how it wound up and the fact that nothing exciting ever came of it.
Mm-hmm. Would it be safe to assume, or would it be so that a device that had an anti-gravity propulsion system affixed to it would possibly be creating its own vortex and just riding on that vortex up to the point where it's no longer necessary? In other words, up to the point where it's that craft is no longer affected by the force of gravity?
Well, sure. I mean, I don't think that I kind of agree with you. I don't think it's a normal magnetic phenomenon. But,
mm-hmm.
but still, we can use the example of two magnets with the same polarity and the way that they oppose one another. Now, the interesting thing is, you know, almost everybody has toyed around with magnets at one point or another in their lives because they are fascinating. But you can take two very powerful Alnico magnets, for instance, and even though they'll shove each other apart with a considerable amount of force, you don't see the thing take off and go into orbit.
Yes.
It just moves a very short distance, and usually what it does, it flips around on its own so that the opposite polarity presents itself, and then it goes and slams up against the other magnet, and the two things are linked together.
Mm-hmm.
So even though we can use the repulsion concept as an analogy, I really don't think that magnetism, due to the inverse square law that it seems to be governed by, has the ability to, you know, be used to propel something into space, because if you had a magnet big enough and powerful enough to do that, the energy that it would take would be overwhelming. It would probably melt before you got off the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But the suggestion, though, seems to be made by nature itself that there's a related force of some sort which is not limited by the normal inverse square law, and which can provide a thrust.
Mm-hmm.
And that thrust can, in fact, push a device off the face of the Earth. It can allow it to hover, or it can allow it to move at an ungodly speed.
Apparently,
it doesn't take a lot of energy to do that. It just takes knowledge of what that is and what the conditions are that will promote that type of action.
Mm-hmm. I've witnessed some of the United Galactic Federation craft flying, and I've seen a craft. I actually got to watch this over an extended period of time. And when I don't mean over weeks and weeks. I'm saying the incident was over an hour. And I saw the craft at one point. Now, let's say most people would think that the anti-gravity device is forcing the disc to remain parallel to the Earth's surface. And when we see them flying and moving through the air, we generally see this flat disc, and it seems to be riding on air, okay, just to use a simple concept. And I've seen that same craft hovering and then flipping to its edge, like a plate in a dish rack, and staying balanced perfectly there. So gravity wouldn't just be a linear, you know, up or vertical, up and down force. It would have to be permeating the whole entire atmosphere that craft could do that. Or the craft is able to shift its perspective, the perspective of its anti-gravity force to the edge when it's standing on its edge like that. Any thoughts on that?
Well, sure. I mean, I think that if once you understand what that force is, and if you can create it artificially, then there's no reason why you can't adjust it so mm-hmm. that it will manifest however you want it to. I mean, we do the same thing with electromagnets. There's a force which is also intangible, it's invisible, and yet mm-hmm. we've learned to harness that, and we can build electromagnets of any shape and size and use it to do anything from focusing a TV, a scanning beam in a TV set, or to accelerate electrons for the purpose of generating X-rays, mm-hmm. or to run an electric motor. I mean, it's really the same force doing all kinds of different things because we understand how it works now, and we're capable of making the effects manifest the way we want them to. Mm-hmm. I don't see any reason why, if we eventually come to the understanding of what gravity is, that we couldn't do the same thing with that force.
Well,
so
then,
sure, I can imagine some sort of a gravitational unit that produces the effect, and it could be engineered in such a way that we can change the focus of the force or change the direction of the force that's produced.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see why not.
You know, it may be very well that that there is an initial vortex created that has a polarity on one end, and that the craft assumes the opposite polarity and just pushes itself off the very or away from the very vortex it's creating by just manipulating the vortex.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no reason why something like that can't happen. If you look at it this way, whatever gravity is, we know enough about it at least appreciate the fact that it starts operating at a pretty high altitude, and it brings things from that fringe of the atmosphere all the way down to the surface of the planet, pretty much effortlessly.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could reverse that effect and create it artificially but with the reverse polarity, the thing that would be so cool about it would be that the objects would be falling up. And it wouldn't take any more effort for them to fall up than it takes for something to fall down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily...
other exciting characteristics of a force of that nature, too, because... if it was created, let's say, in the very center, the geometric center of some kind of a circular craft, for instance, as Carini and Goetz and all those guys hypothesized, then that force, even though it was artificial, would operate on every atom in that craft. And so the occupants, the ship, and the way it was propelled would all be moving in the same reference frame under the influence of the same force. Mm-hmm. So as far as the occupants were concerned, there wouldn't be any acceleration. There wouldn't be any forces like we feel, for instance, when we take a car around a corner at 60 miles an hour and you find yourself leaning off to the side under the influence of centrifugal force. There wouldn't be any of that stuff because everything would just be locked together in one continuous reference frame that was solidified by this artificially produced homogeneous field that just tied everything together and at the same time repelled or otherwise pushed away from the Earth's natural field of the same type.
Mm-hmm.
So you wouldn't have an uncomfortable ride no matter what the maneuvers were that the ship was attempting to execute.
Yeah. I would think one would have to become acclimated to the speed and maybe some of the metaphysical transitions that occur when one is moving through a dimensional portal or going at greater than the speed of light. One would have to certainly adapt their physiology to the experience. That would come with time, I would presume. But then we have this issue of getting beyond the point where gravity is a concern. In other words, once you're far enough out into the atmosphere or the ionosphere, through the ionosphere, to the point where your only concern now is to move against matter, to maintain your own matter, your own shape, and still work against matter. Because you get a certain distance from a planet, there's no gravitational force, we'll say. I don't like the word pull, so we'll say force. Would you like to comment on that? We don't have much time here, and it's a lot to get you to open up another topic and not give you the courtesy of expounding on it.
Well, you know, as I have admitted to you before, I don't really know too much about antimatter or how it's produced. But one of the fascinating possibilities is that antimatter might also have an anti-inertia of some sort, or characteristics that affect the inertia of the craft itself when this material is released.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if that's the case, then you've got an amazing source of thrust. And by the way, I think that the two things could still be used in conjunction in deep space traveling, because the production of an artificial G-field to surround the whole ship and make the occupants and the structure all exist in the same reference frame would also protect you from inertial accelerations, because the forces that were produced, let's say, by the emission of this stream of antiparticles or whatever would be producing your thrust would actually operate against the ship, but then the gravitational field of the ship would transfer all that momentum or that force into the occupants as well, so that every atom would be moving in unison, whether the part of the ship mm-hmm. or part of you. And so you could move at fantastic speeds and make right-angle turns and everything else, then you'd be just as comfortable as if you were laying on a couch with your feet up somewhere. You wouldn't even necessarily feel the motion. And I think that's one of the most amazing things about that force. I mean, if you stop and think about what we're saying, you know, if a car is moving at 60 miles an hour and the occupants are sitting there moving also at 60 miles an hour, when you step suddenly on the brake, and let's say you really step on it hard, the reason that people go flying forward is because no force was exerted on them.
Mm-hmm.
The force was exerted on the car, and they're not part of the car. So the natural tendency is for their personal mass to continue on at 60 miles an hour until they smear all over the dashboard. But if you had a force that was acting on every atom in their body, as well as every atom in the car, when you applied the brakes, you wouldn't feel a thing. You wouldn't go forward. You wouldn't have any discomfort. There'd be no relative motion. And without relative motion, you can't have acceleration, and you can't have the appearance of an inertial force.
Yeah, it's a fascinating topic. I'm visualizing things, but I'll just end up adding another half an hour to the show, and we don't want to do that tonight. But it's fascinating. I'm inclined to agree with you on that, and there's also a difference, you know, between an automobile and its passengers, and a flying saucer and its passengers. And the difference is that in the first case, the automobile is not a sentient being. It's not symbiotic. Maybe the gas pedal is, because it's being applied constantly, in a sense, I'm saying, and the steering wheel. And the little adjustments one might make to a rear view mirror. But other than that, the craft, now the flying saucer, is designed to be integrated with the operator. They become one, as do the passengers to some extent. They can go on carrying their duties and continue being human. But this aspect of the craft being so intelligent and knowing the intentions of the pilot and the co-pilot speaks volumes about the technology and the primitive nature of our science on this planet. Any closing remarks you'd like to make, Jim?
Well, I think that what you just said, you know, gives us a glimpse as to, you know, just what these people have managed to harness when they build machines to work this way. Because, as you say, if you had a craft of that sort, you could be traveling two-thirds the speed of light and make a right-hand turn, and nobody would have to be strapped down. Nobody would have to worry about being in a special chair or some kind of a special cylinder or something. They would just be doing whatever they normally do, and they wouldn't even be aware of the turn. So I think that that's an interesting thought, because the concept of integrating, of integration of all of the atoms, you might say, that are involved by making use of this particular force is like step one. And step two is, well, okay, as long as everything is all integrated into one device, then we might as well make that device an intelligent device so that it answers to the thought patterns or the desires of the pilots. I mean, our own Air Force is playing around with stuff like that right now for missile systems and, you know, maneuvering because if they can pick up the electromagnetic thought train and do something with that directly, it's much, much faster than waiting for the thought to become materialized in the movement of a hand, let's say, on a control, and then the control itself has a certain temporal hysteresis that takes time to manifest in the, you know, in the change in the ship's attitude or whatever it is you're trying to control. And all of that takes a lot of time. But if you can initiate a thought and then have the ship respond directly to that, I mean, my gosh, it would cut the response time enormously. And then the whole thing would just be moving as one integrated being. It's an amazing concept.
That's you're describing the scenario at the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount in Jerusalem some months back. I think it was January.
Yeah, I remember the event, but I wasn't there.
Yeah, but I saw the event on three separate videos, and the acceleration from a dead stop in and of itself was fabulous to observe. You know, you don't see him moving that fast in the funny car races. It takes him a while. I mean, just pew, gone that fast. So
I can conceive of it. I wish I had seen the video. It would have been interesting.
Well, I'll have to try to arrange for you to see it, because we do have copies of it. Even though the powers that be took it off the internet, it's still alive and well. So, and who knows?
Good.
We may be able to get some originals, too, someday. So I thought I'd share that with you and the listening audience. Jim, we're out of time. I appreciate your expertise on some of these scientific issues, and I appreciate your honesty where you're not as experienced or not as familiar, but you're certainly capable of thinking outside the box, and it makes for very interesting conversation.
Well, thank you. I've certainly spent enough time trying to learn how to do that, so it's nice to know that I've accomplished it in a small measure.
All right. Well, I'm going to say goodnight to you, and you have a great weekend. And, folks, that wraps it up. We've been listening to Jim Murray on Evident Footprints on BBSRadio.com. I'd like to also thank Wind Talkers Radio Network for broadcasting Evident Footprints. We had Seth Hendrick on the sound tonight at BBS Radio. I'd also like to thank Don and Doug Newsom, co-founders of BBS Radio, for making Evident Footprints possible, and most of all, you, the listening audience, for tuning in. Join me next Monday night when my guest will be Dr. A. True Ott. In the meantime, have a great weekend, and I wish everyone a night filled with peace, love, and light, and have a good night.